Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I am here with just one co-host today, Aaron Lammer. How are you, sir?
Dad's out of town and we're having a party.
Evan got married. Evan got married this weekend. Congratulations to Evan and his wife.
Max officiated.
I did. Yeah. Officially. I officially officiated. I am a registered minister emeritus with the city of New York.
Today is also a big day in our lives. I would say a bigger day. I'd say that this news trumps the marriage news. We are releasing the new Longform app for iPhone and iPad today. We've been working on it for a very long time. This is a whole new thing for us. We like to build things that we ourselves would like. One of the things we built was this podcast, and now we're building a new series of services that are available first for iPhone and iPad users.
Totally free.
I mean, just stop right now. Hit pause, go download it. It's free. What do you need? More information? But if you are interested for more information, we have a lot of cool new features in it, one of which I'm really excited about is following writers. So if you hear someone on the show and you're like, wow, that person's really fascinating, I definitely want to read everything they write, then you go into the app, you follow them, and anytime they publish a new article anywhere on the web, you'll get notified. So this is a great way. What we're trying to do is allow people to branch out. We've been doing these sort of curated recommendations on longform.org. We're allowing you to personalize your own long form by following writers, publishers. You can follow friends and see articles they're recommending. It's a totally self-contained reading universe.
Yeah, we're really trying to build a home for this kind of writing. Anything published anywhere on the web is in there. You can follow any publication. You can follow any writer. And the reading experience is great.
It's clean. It's minimalist. I'm just going to stop talking about it and encourage you to explore it by downloading it. Tell a friend. Please, we don't have a big marketing budget. This is how we get the word out. So please do our job for us. Let people know. Send us feedback. editors@longform.org.
You should also know that this app nearly cost Aaron his life. He's herniated discs.
Yeah.
He had an ulcer.
Yeah. It's been a rough year. We've put every dollar and every minute we have into this. So please give it a run. Who's on the show this week?
Buzz Bissinger.
Oh my God.
Buzz Bissinger. I have been trying to get Buzz Bissinger on the show since we started. I've sent him an email basically every 6 weeks for, I don't know, 2 years. And he finally, I can't even say that he accepted. I believe relented is the right word. And I went down, I took the train down to his house in Philadelphia, and we talked for a long time. This is a slightly longer than normal episode. Also, one note, my microphone had some trouble towards the end, but I don't know. Just listen to it. I really enjoyed it.
For anyone who's not familiar, Buzz Bissinger wrote Friday Night Lights. He wrote a quite incredible article about his addiction to Gucci clothing in last year. He's been on a wild ride. And
won a Pulitzer Prize. He's had a pretty incredible career, both sort of living in public and his journalism.
Yes, absolutely. Do we have any good sponsors this week?
Do we have good sponsors?
This is probably our number one week for sponsors ever. We got some great sponsorships.
And they're doing great stuff. Tiny Letter, the great people at Tiny Letter, are doing a writer's residency.
Yeah.
At the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs, 10 days, all expenses paid. They're going to fly you there, put you up, pay for your meals. All you got to do is write. Go to residency.tinyletter.com to apply. One note, when you do, I am judging this contest. Along with Susan Orlean, who's been on the podcast before, and Roxanne Gay and Dori Shafrir, we are going to pick the five writers that get to go do this awesome residency. Aaron, you cannot do it.
Damn. Anyone who's interested at home, Max likes dad nonfiction. we got another great sponsor, Bonobos. One thing I can say about Bonobos is that I wore a Bonobos tie to Max's wedding. I'm on theme. See that? I'm on theme. From their signature chinos and denim to their tailored suits and dress shirts, Bonobos offers a full line of great-fitting, expertly crafted men's clothing backed by a painless shopping experience. And, for a limited time, Longform listeners can get 20% off their first order with code LONGFORM. So you can go to bonobos.com, that's BONOBOS.com, and you're going to discover the difference that a better-fitting and better-looking wardrobe can make. That's true. Okay, that works.
that's real talk. We've got one more sponsor. Another awesome contest from our friends at EA Sports. The newest version of our favorite video game, FIFA, is about to come out. It's coming out next week. And in anticipation to celebrate...
What is this, FIFA 15?
FIFA 15.
Yeah.
EA Sports and Longform are teaming up. We are trying to find the greatest soccer articles ever written. Look in the show notes. There's a little form. Send us a link. When you do, you'll be automatically entered to win a free Xbox One and a copy of FIFA 15. All you have to do is give us a link to your favorite article, new or old, and you might win a free Xbox.
I want to get in on this.
You're barred from that contest, too.
Bum-ass PS3. Okay, here is Max with Buzz Bissinger.
Buzz Bissinger, hello.
Hey, Max. It's nice to finally see you after dodging you for a year and a half.
For so long. I sent you a lot of emails.
A lot of emails, and I finally said, you know, the only way I'm going to get Max off my fucking back is to do this, because he would send me email like every 2 weeks. How about now?
I was trying to stick to like 6 weeks, every six weeks.
But I am I love long form. I think it's great for a profession in which, you know, there's concern that long form is actually dying, particularly with the way the internet is. So I'm actually happy to do it, to talk about craft or whatever.
Well, I appreciate it. Sure. I certainly appreciate you. Also, we should say I'm in your house. It's a Monday morning.
Right.
Jackhammers are going in Philadelphia.
That's right.
I'm sitting in your apartment. It's all very gracious of you.
Seventh floor. Well, I'm happy to have you. And I'm glad to see that you actually exist.
Not just some random...
And you're probably happy to see that I exist.
I had some confidence that you exist. I've been thinking, I just took the train down here, and I was thinking about where to start, sure. How to start. There are many places to start. And then I walked into your house, and just above your head, it is impossible to miss, is a giant Friday Night Lights book cover poster.
Right.
So I guess maybe we should just start there.
Sure.
Here's a moment I'm interested in about Friday Night Lights is the moment you decided to go.
The moment I decided to go was in the summer of 1988, and that was after securing permission from the town of Odessa to go, to spend a season with a football team, Permian High School in Odessa, Texas. So I wasn't doing it blind. I mean, the gestation of the idea really came about, honestly, when I was 12 or 13 years old. We used to get Sports Illustrated, and I remember reading this article about a high school quarterback from Abilene, Texas, named Jack Mildren, and he was the god of the town and playing in front of 15,000 people, and, you know, his name was on every neon sign, and I just was fascinated. You know, wasn't that much older than me, really.
Did you play sports as a kid?
Yeah, I played football. I loved sports, but I just couldn't imagine, you know, a high school kid playing in front of that many people and being that important. So it stuck with me. The Last Picture Show was a great influence. Somewhat ironically, in that last scene, the guy's leaving town to go to Odessa to work in the oil field. So I guess all things come back around. And then it really hit. I had a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard, and I drove out west with a friend. And we took the southern route, actually through Texas, and went through all these little towns. And they were kind of blown away economically. They were down on their heels. And then you would go by the football stadium, and they literally were gorgeous. You know, there'd be a Texas drought, and it was the only place that was being watered.
Right.
A lot of them had been built during the WPA in the 1930s. And it just hit me out of the blue. It wasn't some sort of conscious, contrived thing, that these were bigger than stadiums. These were shrines. These were temples. And those Friday Night Lights really did have an enduring, powerful impact on small town life in America.
And the religion of that small town football is something that had appealed to you even as a kid. Like there was something.
Yes, yes.
The shrine was also.
I always wanted to live in a small town. I mean, I don't know why. I mean, the closest I ever got was I would go to Boy Scout conventions with my grandmother, you know, in such beautiful places as Dallas, which was hideous, or Cleveland, which was even worse. I wanted to live in a small town, and part of it, too, was at the Philadelphia Inquirer, which was great. It was the heyday, but I wanted to sort of blow myself up and challenge myself and do something, you know, really, really different and out of the box, and this idea really appealed to me, and then I was lucky enough to find the right place, and frankly, people say, well, it must have took months of scientific research. It didn't. It took about a week. I had very little. I do a lot of ideas on instinct, and I just knew Odessa was the right place, and a lot of roads led there once I decided you had to do it in Texas.
You also, how old were you when you moved?
God, to see 1988. I was 34, I think, you know, about to turn 35. I had twin boys who were five, and I went there with my fiance. The marriage didn't last, but I did, the kids did, and the book did. So I guess it all worked out.
It feels like there's some risk there. I mean, you just won a Pulitzer, right?
I'd won a Pulitzer several years earlier.
Oh, okay.
Gene Roberts, the great legendary editor, was really against it. He was really pissed off. He thought it was he kind of trashed the idea. But I remember sitting in his office and said, well, Gene, I'm going. I mean, you know, and I get 2 weeks off, or I can go in 2 weeks. Those are union rules. And I never pulled a union rule. I just felt in my heart this was the time to do it, because I was on the editor track at the Inquirer. I think I could have gone far, who knows. But I felt if I don't do it now, I'll never ever do it. And, you know, I ended up quitting my job at the Inquirer, and, you know, who knows? Who knows what was going to happen? I couldn't go back there. The deal I had made with my fiance, and we got married during the year, was we would go to wherever she got in medical school, which happened to be in Milwaukee.
You know, so you were out either way?
Yeah, I was out.
It was like you got a year and then she was going to get medical school?
Exactly. So, you know, there was a lot of risk. No, I got a decent advance. So it wasn't, you know, I just going by the seat of my pants. But, you know, the risk was it wouldn't work out. And if it didn't work out, you know, what was I going to do?
When did you know it was going to work out?
I think I always knew it would work out if I could pull it off, because the season was kind of magical. You know, a lot of my father always said, you have to be close to be lucky. And I knew I was close. And then, you know, in the book business, you just need fortuitous luck. It was a great story. And Odessa was almost like a third world country. It was just so out there in Texas. It had very much aspects of the Wild West. It was insulated, and the football season, there were so many ups and downs, not just in terms of the football season, but in terms of the sociology and the black running back Boobie Miles getting hurt, and then the racism that poured out. And then the you know, you're always looking for storytelling. You're looking for narrative, and the ups and downs of the season were unbelievable. They almost don't make the playoffs. They play a team that ended up getting, you know, a Dallas team that enormous controversy that was and ended up being stripped of the trophy. And that game was like a race war. Everything that you wanted to happen could have happened. Now, did it all come together magically? No, it was kind of a disaster at the beginning. It was sort of a mess. It was a mess. Not sort of a mess. It was a mess.
How so?
Well, you know, I thought, like, well, I'm a book writer now, so I'm not going to outline. It all has to be inspiration. I don't need any stinking outline. I'm a book writer. It's all going to come from my heart. I'm going to get up early in the morning, and it's just going to pour out, and then I'll have a few bolts of scotch. So I just started writing. I set an arbitrary date, April 1st, basically, of 1989, about 4 months after the season ended. And I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. And my editor called and said, I got to see what you're doing, because, you know, there is a deadline. And I sent it to her, wonderful editor named Jane Isay at Addison Wesley. And normally, you know, editors, they take a week, they take 2 weeks, they take a month, they may take a year. You know, editors don't really work that hard. No offense, book editors. Jane got back to me literally a day later, which was an indication of something. And it was an indication if she said, so when are you going to be in New York next? And I said, I don't know, you know, we're moving now, and, you know, stuff's going on. It was now the middle of the summer. We got to get to Milwaukee.
You were in Odessa at the time.
Yes.
You were writing it while in Odessa.
Yeah, which was impossible, actually.
Yeah.
As I found out. And she said, well, I think you need to come to New York tomorrow. Or if you can't tomorrow, the next day. I got to see you within a week. Well, then I know there were some problems. And she said, look, I don't want to insult your feelings. When I got to New York, she said that the rate we're going, this is going to be longer than William Shire's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And no offense, Odessa's not Nazi Germany. It has no engine. There's no narrative drive. It's going on forever. You spent 150 pages on the history of the town. I'd written about 30,000 words. But it was then at that moment that I learned a really valuable lesson about how to write books, because Jane said, look, I have some index cards. Let's go through the key characters, the key games, the key themes. And I would hem and haw. And she said, no, come on, let's go. What's rising to the top? Who are the players? Well, Mike Winchell, the quarterback. Don Billingsley, the running back. Boobie Miles, the black running back. What are the key games? Well, you know, Odessa High versus Permian. It's an intercity war, intercity rivalry. And she said, well, why? It needs something beyond that. Well, you know, to me, it shows the socioeconomics of the town. She said, all right, keep going, keep going, keep going. And then we put it all up on a corkboard, and then the book really came alive after that. And then I went back, really stripped it out chapter by chapter and then scene by scene, section by section within the chapter. And pretty much about 2 to 3 weeks in, I knew this thing can really go. You just felt, and it was organized, it was moving, it had the narrative line that I was looking for.
Was it, I mean, it was about structure and narrative, or had you found something about the story that you didn't know was there? Like, reading back through, you know, I've read a bunch of interviews from that time and shortly after, and 10-year anniversaries and 15-year anniversaries, 20 anniversaries. And
right, I'm trying to milk it for every possible anniversary that I can.
Well, I'm interested in how you feel about the thing now.
Actually, it's going to be the 25th anniversary. Yeah. Isn't it? Oh, my God. I'm so old.
You're going to have to do this whole conversation again.
What the hell happened?
If people email you enough.
I get emails every week. I mean, I got an email today from it was a lovely email from a teacher. I don't know where, saying I'm teaching it to my junior students in high school and a lot of special ed kids. And it was very poignant. She said, I'm trying to find an audio of the book, but I can't. And the only one available costs $150. And do you have one? And I give her one. I don't know if I have any extras. But I get emails all the time, you know, and I've accepted the fact that I'm Mr. Friday Night Lights, at least to some degree.
You found peace with that?
More peace. I mean, you know, sometimes I have, sometimes I haven't. I mean, I've written about that, and it became kind of a noose at times. It really is impossible at the top. The book still sells. It sells, I don't know, 40 between, and it sells very well in Britain. It sells about 40,000 copies a year still. I think there are 2 million copies in print. TV show, movie, I'm waiting for the musical, the passion play. Yeah. You know, the Sunday morning TV sermon. Yeah, the one-man show, Bryan Cranston, because he can obviously do a Texas accent. But I have come to peace with it. Look, it's a great thing. It's as my father said, it's a good problem to have. But, you know, any writer, you want to top yourself. You want momentum. You want to keep going. And it is difficult because we burn out. And, you know, I'm in an age where you wonder what's really left. It gets harder and harder. Book business is really, really hard. They're much more demanding in terms of ideas. So you're trying to think really commercial. And frankly, everything you come up with, it seems like someone else is doing it. So I have no books on the horizon.
There's nothing in the works?
No. They're demanding. They're lonely. They're isolated. And I just can't come up with an idea that I can really wrap my arms around. You know, Father's Day was very proud of, but it didn't sell very well. And, you know, that's a knock against you. You know how it works. They go on Nielsen and
you're only as good as your last book?
Yeah, although, you know, I think with Friday Night Lights, I've gotten a number of shots. And, you know, I think after Father's Day, I think there's a reticence. And, you know, does that mean I have to write another? I don't know. I don't know. You know, I could have been Lauren Hillenbrand. That's what I said. but my tastes were probably too. My taste as a writer in terms of commercialism, I've had good success with Friday Night Lights and Three Nights in August, but I'm eclectic. I mean, I didn't write sports all my life.
Right, you didn't keep writing. No. You didn't do the next season with another team.
No, if I'm known for anything, people call me a sports writer, which I'm not. Friday Night Lights, I don't think, was a sports book at all. When I write something related to sports, I try to write much more about sports than the games themselves. I don't really give a crap about the games. I think they're kind of boring, frankly.
When you went to go write that book, did you care more about the games? Like, did you expect it was going to be a story about race and class? And I mean, it gets messy quickly in the book.
Well, it does get messy quickly because the season got messy quickly. You know, you're aware of the themes of the town, but you don't know what's going to play out. Obviously, I didn't predict that, you know, Boobie Miles, the great black savior of the team, was going to get hurt in preseason, and certainly had no idea of the outpouring of racism, you know, that would occur. It was only until I spent time in classrooms that I realized just how appallingly bad education was in that school. So things, you know, play out. When the coach almost didn't get in the playoffs and the for sale signs in his lawn and the letters to the editor saying basically he's a bum and they should be fired, he lost 3 games by a single point. You know, you see these themes develop. But there was always an eye towards making it, you know, sociological. You know, when I was at the Inquirer. I mean, you know, Gene Roberts didn't say much, but when he said things, you listened. And he said, you know, you're really the best writer is the best reporter. Zig while others zag. And that always stayed with me. So I wanted to try to do something, you know, beyond just the one dimension of you know, this game, that game. That was important to me, and storytelling and narrative and trying to develop character.
You tired of talking about the book?
You know, no. I mean, I doubt I'm saying anything original about it, but, you know, no. Maybe. I don't know. You know, sometimes I get tired of talking about writing. You know, I just sort of...
Thank you for doing the podcast.
I sort of just do it. Although I did something at Penn that I really enjoyed. I mean, there's a wonderful thing called the Kelly Writer's House at Penn, and I was a fellow there, and they really had read my books very carefully. And what was actually delightful was the book they cared about the most, there were two, was A Prayer for the City, which was about urban Philadelphia through the eyes of the mayor, Ed Rendell, and Father's Day. Friday Night Lights was not mentioned at all, which was really nice for me because, you know, you kind of remember, hey, folks, I've written something else. You know, no, I didn't do the TV show, but I, you know, no, I didn't write it. Although at this point, I take credit for everything.
We got to, sure.
But, you know, Friday Lights opens a lot of doors. I mean, it does.
Well, it sounds like I picked the right place to start.
You did.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to pause things for a second and tell you about one of our sponsors this week. It's a fitting sponsor, given that today's episode is with Buzz Bissinger, man of style. Bonobos. Bonobos is the sponsor. They are a men's apparel company, and they offer a full line, everything from washed chinos, denim, shorts, swim, and casual shirts, to suits, dress shirts, and blazers. Bonobos has a free shipping policy and a stellar customer service team that makes the whole shopping experience stress-free, super convenient, way, way more pleasant than going to the store. For those of you who can't wear jeans to work, check out the Bonobos Weekday Warriors. That's non-iron dress slacks named after every day of the week. You can pair the Weekday Warriors with one of their dress shirts, which are available in three different fits: slim tailored, slim and standard. Getting dressed for work really couldn't be easier. They're offering our listeners a special deal. If you use the code LONGFORM, you're going to get 20% off your first purchase. So whether you're looking for something casual or office friendly, that's 20% off with the offer code LONGFORM on your first purchase. Free shipping all the way. Bonobos. They're bringing expert craftsmanship, a perfect fit, and incredible service to men's clothing. Go to bonobos.com, find your fit today, use that code LONGFORM. That's BONOBOS.com. And thanks very much to them for sponsoring the show. And now let's get back to Buzz. Can we talk about Father's Day?
Of course.
Father's Day is a book you wrote about your son, Zach.
Yes.
You guys took a cross-country trip.
Right, in 2007, I think. Yeah.
For people who maybe haven't read the book, can you tell us a little bit about
that? Which
Zach?
There are many, I think.
I read
too
the
many.
Book.
I had twin boys, Jerry and Zach. They were born under very traumatic conditions. They were 13 weeks premature, 27 weeks. And Jerry was weighed 1 pound 14, and Zach weighed 1 pound 11. Jerry was in intensive care for 2.5 months, but really miraculously, and as miraculously as Zach, had no residual problems. Jerry just was named principal of his high school in Haddonfield, New Jersey, right outside Philly. He's doing remarkably well. He's engaged. Zach had trace brain damage because of being the second one out and oxygen deprivation. And, you know, sadly, I forget when, but within a decade, they've discovered a way to expand the lungs within the womb.
Oh, wow, so, I didn't realize
so he would have been, I think the drug is called surfactant. And that's made a tremendous difference because this before was a tremendous problem. But, you know, life goes on. Zach had a lot of learning disabilities. Zach's comprehension is low, but he's got a very eerie mind. His ability to recall dates and memories is incredible. And the book was a legitimate attempt to really spend concentrated time with him. I don't think I'd spent a month or 3 weeks with him straight because I got divorced from their mom, who's terrific. I don't think I'd spend a month with him straight by myself. I don't know. Long time. Not since he was 2 years old. And it was an attempt to get to know him, and it was an attempt to reconcile certain feelings that I had grown up with. Disappointment, sadness, why is he different? And it wasn't about, not, you know, some people say, well, that means you don't love him and you're a shithead and you're brutal. Well, it wasn't. It was honest. And I think a lot of parents of special needs kids feel that way, and I wanted to express that. But he really is a blessed creature. He's funny. And he's, you know, people say, what did you learn? I don't know. I learned that the moon comes out every night. I don't know what you really learn in life. But what he is incredibly observant, much more observant than I ever really realized. He just soaks things in, and you know, because he'll come back to repeat them or mimic them. He pays a lot of attention to language, even if he doesn't quite know what it means. My wife, Lisa, worked in Abu Dhabi for several years, and you know, it was traumatic. And when she went off to the Middle East, I had Zach with me, which was nice. And we pulled into the garage, and everything's very, very quiet. And Zach looks at me and says, well, a couple empty nesters. You know, which A, was the perfect thing to say, and B, say, Zach, where did you learn that? And he says, well, my mom said it. And he sort of, he didn't really know what it meant, but he sort of knew what it meant. And all during the trip, he did take care of me. I mean, I've worked on it a lot, but I could snap out and have a bad temper and get frustrated easily. And he was the one really who centered me and consciously tried to calm me down.
I'm not surprised that people ask you, what'd you learn? Because it did feel to me like it was just as much about you as it was about
Zach.
It was. And you trying to parse your own
right.
feelings. The start of the book, you're incredibly hard on yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to be very hard on myself. And I don't know how many people know. I mean, I had a very rough time of it almost a year ago, a year and a half ago. I went into rehab because, you know, really had kind of a breakdown on all cylinders. And that's something I'm proud of, but it's something I had to do. And one of the problems was I was brutally hard on myself. I felt a lot of shame. I felt a lot of guilt. I mean, the reasons for that are always complex, but I really, I don't know if I enjoyed beating myself up, but it is something I'd done all my life. And, you know, I wanted to relay that in the book. I actually sometimes wonder if in the book, not to be indulgent, there should have been more about me in it. You write a book and you always wonder, and it's true of everything, you know, should I have done this? Should I have done that? You know, was the balance right? Because in many ways it really was about me. The title sucked. That was a bad move.
That was your call?
Well, yes, it was kind of my call. And then I thought, well, it's not a very good title, but I have Houghton Mifflin and Eamon Dolan, who's really one of the truly great, great editors. I thought if they didn't like it, they would say so. And you know what? Shit happens. What it did, though, is it centered the book and linked the book so much to the Father's Day that once Father's Day was over, it just disappeared, and it didn't really describe the book. You know, titles are elusive. You know, it's the other fucking thing about Friday Nights. It was like the best title ever invented.
It's a good
and
title.
And that came literally hours before that was it.
Really?
Yeah. We were at lunch.
That's surprising.
And Jane Ice, they said, well, all right, we got to come up with a title. And I was thinking, Dreaming of Heroes. She said, that sounds like shitty poetry. That's no good. And she said, give me something. And I quoted one of the players talking about the magic of the Friday Night Lights. And she said, That's it, you know, and like, so it's like everything. The cover was perfect. Fuck that book. You know, it's like everything was perfect. But Father's Day was a big departure. It was a memoir in a sense, and it's something I wanted to do, and I wanted to try it. You know, I wanted to do something different because I, you know, I'd done traditional long-form narrative. I did a book with LeBron James, it actually gets better with time, and I wanted to.
Oh, you feel better about that LeBron book now?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually thought it was a good story. I mean, I think the problem with that book, which didn't do that well, was it was too early in his career. He really wasn't liked. He's liked now. I mean, there's always going to be controversy.
I mean, it came out right after he went to Miami, right?
No, it came out. Right, it came before. Out before, but he had never won a championship.
Right.
He was young. I think he didn't really take. He didn't understand what it entailed. But, you know, the difficulty was is that it's his book. You know, he could do anything he wants, although he changed very little. And I don't think there's a real controversial story to LeBron. LeBron's pretty simple. LeBron is very smart. He's very intuitive. He's very savvy. But his backstory is really not that complicated. It's not. He was not a kid who looked for trouble. He didn't like to get in trouble. The one thing about LeBron was he hated being alone. And he hated being alone because he was left alone. And all of that was in the book. And it was an ensemble book. So I, you know, there's talk about bringing it out again. I suggest that the publisher.
Yeah, were you surprised you went back?
No, I wasn't surprised he went back for several reasons. I think he likes to shake things up. He does love that area. He's been great for Akron, and I guess by extension Cleveland, although Akronites will tell you, well, you know, he really never lived in Cleveland. And I think he wanted the idea of sort of starting from scratch. I don't know how much LeBron liked that constant pressure of you should win every year. You should be winning every year. It's a lot of pressure. And I don't think LeBron's the type of guy who's going to play for 20 years. I just don't. I could see LeBron playing five more years and saying, you know what? I want to do something different. I want to be like Magic Johnson. I want to own a baseball team. The guy has very big ambitions. And I was very critical of him at the beginning. I was in that bad period of Twitter and being a shithead to everyone and being a real bombastic schmuck, which I'm not anymore. And it was a bad persona. But I also realized the hatred of LeBron was insane. Was insane. People were so happy when he failed that first year with the Heat, and there was the whole, you know, I'm taking my talents to Miami and that whole way he did that. But, you know, he hasn't killed anybody. He's really been a pretty good citizen and has become a very good spokesman for the league.
So. Yeah, and he won people back. I mean, it did feel to me like a big part of going back to Cleveland is just trying to like right the one real wrong in his life.
I think that's it. I think it's fun. I mean, it's fun. You know, look, it's his team. You know, he's obviously dictating the trades. He's a magical player, although I don't think he shoots enough. And I think it's fun. And I think it is, yeah. I mean, you know, it's kind of, what are you going to criticize him for now? That he screwed Cleveland? Well, he's going back to Cleveland. You know, he left Miami. So the people will find something, but I think that's a good point.
I don't know why I'm so interested in talking about LeBron, but you feel like he's not efficient enough? Like, that's his whole thing about not shooting, right?
Is that I think he's passes.
He's trying to play the perfect game.
Yes, I think he passes too much. I mean, I think sometimes just go to the hoop, man.
You just wrote a piece about the quarterback of the Eagles.
Right, Nick Foles.
That had a similar thesis, or at least it felt like you were writing it from the same place, which is that you wanted him to be the man and want to be the man.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, you can all be the man you can be, and Nick had a great last year. He came out of nowhere in his second year and threw 27 touchdowns and 3 interceptions. He didn't start the whole year. I maintain about Nick, the one thing that's missing is there's absolutely no edge. There's no affect of any kind. And arrogance comes in athletes in all certain different ways. You know, you can be very quiet and have an edge. You can see a certain intensity that is just there. And I don't think he has it. You know, he's kind of golly gee whiz. He's very religious, which is fine, but I almost think he proselytizes sometimes. And I don't know if there's a place for that type of religion in the game. You know, I almost think it should be kept private.
He turned you down for an interview, too.
Yeah, he turned me down for an interview, and people say, well, you took it out on him, which I really, the piece is 90% positive. It's like everything in the world. You know, there was the ending, which I believed, and, you know, people just read 4 paragraphs. Controversial, sensationally negative story about Nick Foles. Give me a break. I mean, it wasn't. It was about that he's kind, that he's decent, that he works his ass off, that he's always defied expectations. But, you know, Tom McGrath, the editor of the Philadelphia Magazine, made a good point. He said, no, there's no nuance anymore. Because of the internet and because of this desperate desire to find something and to get it out there and get attention, people don't read things with nuance. I mean, I tried to make it nuanced. There was a whole last section about his reaction to seeing his best friend almost die on the field. And that, to me, also showed he has a certain maturity. I mean, that was like irrelevant. I did say he was chicken shit, and that was a little provocative. I will admit to that. But he just lacks an edge. Now, you know, he's not LeBron. LeBron is a better gifted athlete. But, you know, look, I mean, LeBron did something with me. Tony La Russa did something with me. Albert Pujols did something with me. You look every day and you see people who cooperate with the media. I mean, Nick, you know, it's too late for you to say, I don't want to add any attention to myself. I mean, you're the franchise quarterback now. You know, the next whatever. And I was pissed off. I take professional pride. I was shocked because they asked me to do it because of the link of Friday Night Lights. He went to Westlake High in Austin. Pete Berg, when he made the movie Friday Night Lights, he used Westlake High for research. Westlake High, something had happened there when a kid was paralyzed on another team in the playoffs. That became the basis for the pilot of the movie. Nick once said, I'm like a character out of Friday Night Lights. Well, if you're a character out of Friday Night Lights, talk to the guy who wrote Friday Night Lights, and I'll decide whether or not you're a character. So I have to say about Nick, though, is when he was asked, you know, like his, you know, training camp started, like the first question he was asked about this. And I said, people get a life. And he was very articulate. He actually was quite good. So you know what?
You didn't even get that thoughtfulness.
He was very thoughtful.
Yeah.
And you know what? People say, well, you want to change your mind if you talk to him. That's absolutely not true. It has always been my experience that subjects, when they talk to you, even if they think it's going to be negative, the story always comes out more balanced than better. It does. You know, I had to go with what I had, and I had to go with what people told me. I mean, it wasn't, and what I found. He is the son of a very, very rich family, probably the richest family in the NFL, or certainly one of the richest. He's lived a very insulated life. In high school, he didn't have a single African-American teammate. Westlake is one of the most insulated places in the country. I didn't make that stuff up. He doesn't do well under pressure. He's lost every big game. I didn't make that stuff up. There is a real reticence to him and a real shyness to him. And he was goofy in high school. I didn't make that stuff up.
Do you think there's any chance that he didn't want to talk to you because you're you?
You know, I don't know. I actually don't think so. I mean, I think to his credit, he honestly feels there is a true contrition to him, and it's been there forever. I don't want to draw attention to myself. And, you know, could the Eagles have said to do it? Yeah, but the Eagles don't care about print. They only care about Twitter and Facebook. You know, could the, and my dealings with them were somewhat difficult. But I think he honestly felt it's not appropriate, and I tried to argue with his agent, with his parents, with the team, you know, that it's a Philadelphia publication. You have an obligation to the media, and it's not a negative story. I probably would have liked them a lot. I just want to hang with them for a day. I mean, it's not too much to ask, is it? Is 8 hours too much to ask? Well, I guess it was.
What you should have done is just email him like every 6 weeks for a year and a half.
You say it's every 6 weeks. I remember it being like every other day. And maybe he would have said, the only way I'm going to get this guy off my back is
I'll let this guy
this.
Come to my
But,
apartment.
You know, I tried all the avenues and, you know. And
yeah.
The thing that I even gave him a book, Friday Night Lights, signed, and I would like that back, actually. And I gave one to his parents, and I would like that back as well.
Can we talk a little bit more about Father's Day?
Yeah, sure.
I'm interested in what Jerry's response was.
Jerry read the book beforehand. So did my wife, Lisa. So did Caleb. You know, I felt they should. Zach couldn't. He wouldn't really understand it. He's never read it. And it wasn't so they could change things. It was for them to know what was going to happen. You know, Jerry loved the book. He felt guilt. It made him remember some things that were difficult about how different Zach was, and you know, maybe feeling a greater obligation to Zach. But you know what? They're twins. They're brothers. So there's always going to be that brother thing going on. I think, you know, Jerry became very conscious. You know, there for the grace of God go I. You know, mm-hmm. 3 minutes. 3 minutes different. That 3 minutes really can determine a lifetime. That much, you know, I do know. Jerry was out 3 minutes earlier, and you know, made all the difference. I'm happy to report Zach is doing phenomenally well. And this apartment, in a sense, is really his. He lives here now 5 nights a week. He has thrived on independence. He does the laundry. He can cook in a microwave. He's neat. He's much neater than my other kids. And he's really, really doing well. I mean, he just, seems like every week, he's picking up more and more and more, and his vocabulary improves. He is a remarkable kid, and he's still very funny, very quirky.
You've mentioned it a couple times, these 3 minutes. It's like these moments, these very, very brief moments where life can change
right
forever, is a theme in a lot of your work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to
Booby.
Well, that's actually a really good point. It is a theme.
Barbaro.
Right. Oh yeah, Barbaro. Well, actually, that's an excellent point. See, I love it when people make points that as a writer you sort of take credit for, and you say, yeah, what's he talking about? This sort of accent. But there is a reason for that. I mean, the first big story narrative story I ever did was about a plane that fell from the sky. And that was written when I was at the St. Paul Pioneer Press and really got me known. It was a runner-up for the Pulitzer and won the Livingston Award. And that was about 44 seconds. So, and there is a reason for all that, because what I try to take the smallest chunk of time possible and then report the hell out of it. And so 44 seconds. Barbaro is defined by that moment when he leaves the gate at the Preakness and his ankle is shattered. You know, the people said, when did you know you had a book, Friday Night Lights? When Boobie got hurt. And that took a millisecond. And it was completely accidental. It wasn't even hit that hard. Those are the moments when you have a book. You know, Prayer for the City was much harder because, you know, it was a 4 years. And how the hell do you make that into a, you know, compress that? That's why people like doing so many seasons of the Life books. I feel responsible for this incredible outpouring. And I think there's been enough of them. But a season is great because, particularly football season, because it's compact. So you're always looking for a compact narrative, and sometimes you get them, and sometimes Father's Day, compact, you know, compact. 3 weeks, 2 weeks, I guess.
Two-week trip. It's going
to
end.
So there is a method, you know, to the madness when I'm looking for narrative, and sometimes you get it, you know, sometimes you don't. You know, writing is obviously difficult. The really elusive part is narrative. Is finding that narrative line that has enough drama to, you know, keep it going. Jane Isay said, I remember when the book was a mess, she said, do you ever read mysteries? You know, mysteries, why would I read mysteries? I'm much too erudite to read mysteries. And she said, well, maybe you should read them, because whatever you think of the writing, they're really good at that. They make you turn the page. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with turning the page, because if people don't turn the page, they're not going to finish the book, and they may not pick it up. I'm sure you've seen this new rating that's been done, I think, by a professor at Wisconsin or wherever, where, you know, you can tell by the number of underlined passages in Kindle how far people have gone in the book. Hillary Clinton, 2%. Piketty, 2.4%. Michael Lewis, 21%. It's pretty low. People get turned off pretty quickly, and so you got to hook them. You got to hook them.
I read Father's Day on a Kindle. All of the highlighted passages, like all the ones that pop up, are all about you.
Are they in the like first 20 pages, or are they at the end?
It falls off. But it's interesting. Interesting. The thing that people gravitate towards is you and you wrestling with these demons about yourself as a father. That's what they, you know, there's a couple of moments where you sort of take a step back and say, what does this mean about me?
Right. And there are water moments. And I, you know, look, that was the intent of the book. I never wrote the book to make myself a hero. I was
Did it make
hard
you feel better, though?
It didn't necessarily make me feel better. It made me feel honest. Was there something cathartic in saying what a shithead you are? And I wasn't really that awful. But no, I mean, but I felt, look, if you're going to, what's the point of running this book? This wasn't the first book written on the subject. But, you know, it was one of the few books that was brutally honest. You are disappointed. You do have aspirations. It does hurt when, you know, my son's going to Yale and my daughter's going to Harvard or Bucknell or wherever, and you have a son who's never going to college, who's always going to be working, you know, for a law firm stocking supplies and at a grocery store. But, I mean, I've gotten over that. Parents are selfish. Parents want their kids to do well because it makes them feel good. I mean, any parent who says that is a liar. But, you know, and I also bled for Zach, and then the juxtaposition of having a twin who was really making his way in the world, and, you know, as good as Zach is doing, they're really, you know, limitations. I mean, this is a small thing. He was cooking in the microwave, and this was my fault. He used the wrong plate. There was a spark. Could have been a fire. Now, I was here, and he told me, well, what happens if I'm not here? What happens if there's a fire? You know, what do? Well, you call 911. Well, you know, you got to put it out. And there are always those moments. But I also feel that Zach needs independence, and I realize that also within the book. He thrives on it, and he can handle it. He's really independent now, and it really helps his life.
That's great. The book is very honest. There's a lot that you've written that is very honest. Do you ever regret being so honest publicly?
No, I mean, you know, we're going to probably get to the GQ story, maybe or maybe not. But I mean, that there was a period in which I felt, and I feel too much, I was writing about myself. And Father's Day was the beginning of that. And then I wrote a GQ story that was very sexually explicit about my own experimentation and by my obsession with clothing, mostly leather. It was a very honest piece. It was very, very flawed. And it was almost, I don't regret it. I mean, I actually think some people sort of got a lot out of it. The obsession, the honesty, you know, clothing addictions do exist. And, you know, symbolic of something more. And there was a lot of other stuff going on that I didn't write about, you know, dabbling with drugs and some other stuff that was personally dangerous to me. But it was really, I think, a cry for help in many ways, because the day it came out, I did go into rehab.
Literally the day it came out.
Yeah. And I knew it would be controversial, and I've never read the reaction, which is...
Really?
No. There's no point. I mean, I heard about it. I heard a lot of it was negative. I mean, it's like... I just heard a lot of it was negative. You know, the Today Show, Matt Lauer became fascinated by it. And when I got out, they called several times, wanted me to do something. And I just didn't want to do it. But, I don't regret it. I mean, I think it's part of your growth as a writer. And really your growth as a human being. Would I have gone to the rehab without writing it? You know, I don't know. But I also realized... there was a real self-destructiveness to that story. I mean, I knew that because I sort of knew in my head that my kids would find it really, really, really disturbing. And I did not show it to them. And I think I was at the stage in my life where almost consciously I wanted to destroy my link to everything, including my kids and my wife. You know, it was really hard for her. She's getting phone calls from reporters. You know, what are you talking to me for? My youngest son, Caleb, was really devastated, and it's taken work to kind of get him back. He was really embarrassed.
Did they have any idea it was coming?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I let them know. No, I mean, Caleb said that he was a Kenyan, and people went up to him and said, "What's with your dad? It's like he's gone nuts, or what the hell is this?" And he said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, this story in GQ." So I think that... You know, I often show things to him. He's very smart. He's a good writer. And I didn't. And I think that was really the cry for help, was to be that hard on yourself in a sense and that self-destructive, then you need some help professionally, and you need it intensively. So it's hard to do. When you think about it, you're kind of amazed that you did it, at least for me. The glow wears off, but there really have been some enduring lessons, including that my wife and I moved to a very, very remote place because there's just not a lot of noise. There's not a lot of hearing about what other writers are doing. And there is, I am not religious, but there's a very, very much a spiritual connection with nature. It's just absolutely beautiful.
What do you feel like the flaws in the piece were?
I haven't read it over. I mean, I think it was there was too much about this, the delight of clothing. I think the ending was kind of fucked up because it was sort of about, you know, how great Gucci was, and you know, I didn't want to screw them. I'd taken this trip, and I didn't want to bash them. But I think that I should have been more thoughtful as to what I put in and also how I wrote about it. And I created the wrong impression. Everyone thought that this guy has gone into rehab and is fucked up because of a clothing addiction, and that's bullshit. Shopping addictions are bullshit. First of all, they're not bullshit because they're symbolic of something else.
But I think you got at that in that piece, that there was...
I tried to, but a lot of people, you know, either made fun of it or misinterpreted it. But, you know, it's the net. They're going to make fun of anything you do. I was thinking about it today because I knew I couldn't get rid of you. I actually were hoping you were the cable guy, but you're not, because the cable guy came and went. But... the ending was bad. I mean, you know, it was sort of parading the fact that you're wearing all this very, very expensive clothing. And I love clothing. I still love clothing. And I just sort of didn't like thinking about it. But I you know, there's no stock in rereading it. There was absolutely no stock in seeing what the reaction was, whether it was good or bad, because it makes no difference, you know. Do I Google my name once a month? I used to do it 3 or 4 times a day. There's no stock in doing that. And you know, when I read stuff about myself, I don't get upset one way or another. It's just all part of the machine.
I mean, in the years running up to that piece, you know, you were living quite publicly on the internet.
Yeah, and I went through a phase, and I'm not sure what the phase was. And part of the phase was that in this world now, you have to put on a certain hat to get noticed. And for me, it sort of started with Twitter, where I adopted this persona of being extremely profane and extremely outspoken.
Using the phrase douche juice a lot.
You know, douche juice and mean and cruel. Lost a lot of friends, you know. LeBron was never a friend, but he was someone I knew, and that went away. Tony La Russa, forget it. We were very good friends. You know, I criticized him. I trashed him. I trashed a lot of people. And it got me 35,000 followers, and I'm off Twitter now. I mean, I got rid of it. So,
you miss it?
No, no, because you know, and I was sort of the speed Twitterite, and I would do 65 tweets in an hour and get on these jags. No, because I think it was getting me away from serious writing. I think it was like me-ism. I was coming the persona, but it got me a radio gig that, you know, didn't work out for a lot of reasons. It got me the possibility of a sports show on the web that I gave up when I went into rehab, a serious sports show on the web, underwritten by Lexus. Got me on all these shows. You know, I was doing shows left and right, and I've given most of it up. I didn't like who I was. My wife hated it. And, you know, when you sort of get into the opinion game, and particularly when you're doing radio, all you do is spout opinions. Right. Part of it is because you're testing your opinions out, but that's your persona. And a lot of people loved Twitter. They thought it was really funny, but, you know, I just didn't want to do it anymore. I don't think it was good. I don't think it was good for me, and I don't think it didn't make me feel any better about myself.
Was the appeal of it initially just getting that, like, dopamine hit, do you think?
The appeal was dopamine, and then the appeal was it got attention. And I did get tired of getting, you know, I'd read, I don't know, I like 70 followers, and anyone who would write about me would trash me for something. You know, you're fat, you're short, you stink, you smell. And I got really, and I started to fight back. And I can be very acerbic and very, very cynical and pretty biting. And so I started to fight back, and then people wrote about it. And then I got more followers. You know, Deadspin wrote about it. And I have this very odd, funny, actually good relationship. They wrote about it. And then David Carr wrote about it. And then the LA Times wrote about it. It gets you more and more followers. And then part of it is you want more, you know, you get addicted to followers. You get addicted to getting on a jag. I would do like 65 tweets in an hour. But it also was wasting a lot of time. You know, it also was a great excuse not to write, not to work, to fuck around. You know, I'd just do it for an hour. Then it's, you know, then you see so you tweet for an hour. And then you read all the reaction to your tweets for another hour. And then you read your tweets again, and so you've wasted 3 hours of the day. And unfortunately, I think that's the persona that works today. I think that works. I think that's what our society wants. That's what the net encourages, is snarlyism, eccentricity, distinguishing yourself. And look, you know, a lot of writers have Twitter accounts. And most have about 40 people on them. I mean, I know there are others. There's some who have a lot of and really work it. Jennifer Weiner has a lot. But I realize, you know, if I think I'm going to get followers because of the books that I wrote, that ain't going to happen. You have to create a distinct persona. So I sort of became the profane curmudgeon, basically, really curmudgeonly. People compare me to Lewis Black, which is nice because Lewis Black can be funny. But I just wasn't, in a sense, in rehab. It just was not comfortable with it. And I quit it before. Yeah, I just didn't want to do it anymore. I just didn't. And you know, when you're doing something where you're losing friends and to a certain degree embarrassing yourself or just putting yourself out there nakedly, people have heard enough about me, I think, until I find some great idea that involves me, and then, of course, I'll do it.
Well, it's interesting to say that the problem is putting yourself out there nakedly, because most of what you were just saying was that it wasn't quite you. It didn't really feel like you.
Well, it's an interesting observation. It was in a phase of my life where I don't really give a shit. And it was a phase of my life where I'm going to be really, really outspoken. So when I wrote about LeBron, you know, saying what was he thinking when he did that press conference announcing he was going to Miami, I mean, I thought it was despicable at the time, but then I would take it to the nth degree. You know, I would criticize people, and it would be in good faith. But bit by bit, I realized it wasn't very nuanced, and it was mean and not very well thought out. It really had no thought to it at all. And then when I sort of went into radio for a while, I mean, that's all you do. You know, you're trying to get attention any way you can. And the more out there you are, the more ridiculous things you say, the more attention you want. Nuance is not a big part of our society anymore. It's just not. You know, you can write a piece that's really nuanced, and you're trying to suggest different things and get across different moods. You know, if you have one paragraph in there that's the remotely negative or controversial, that's what people are going to concentrate on. So it's that's the world today, and Twitter is great for that. And I was really good at it. I was really good at 140 characters and giving, really zinging people. I have to say that I was among the better Twitterites.
You were really good at Twittering. You were a great Twitterer.
Right.
You were good at getting attention and being bombastic.
Right.
But you would really thoughtfully apologize.
Well, I would thoughtfully apologize, and I actually think I am honest. So I would thoughtfully apologize because I tend to do things, and then probably like a lot of people, then I dwell on it. I think about it. I think where I've, gone over the top. I mean, in the Leech thing, the problem was I didn't really know a lot about the web. I knew very little about. I didn't really do a lot of research. I knew very little about these blogs. The worst thing I did was, and this is, any lawyer will tell you this, I asked a question I didn't know the answer to, and Leech answered it. He knew who W.C. Hinds was, and then I said, oh, shit, now I'm really in trouble. I really have to go on the offensive. And the reaction to that was, there was a overwhelmingly negative reaction. And, you know, when people write and say, you know, I loved your writing, I'm going to burn your book, you know, whether it's one people or 10, and there were a fair amount, that made me realize I had gone over the top. Look, part of it is, you know, this is an age in which you say something and then, you know, you try to apologize and maybe to squirm your way out of it. And maybe, you know, subconsciously, that was part of it. The problem with Twitter was you can only do that. You have to be angry. You have to be angry all the time. You really have to get going into that zone of anger. And that's really not healthy. I mean, the observation was made when I was in rehab was, you know, all you really care about is noise. Positive noise, negative noise, that's all you really care about. And that's going to be very debilitating at a certain point because you're always going to be agitated in your life, you know, and then that's why we moved. I mean, you can't find a place more different from Philadelphia. I grew up in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. You're not going to find a place any more different than Long Beach, Washington. I mean, Long Beach, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. They're good people. It's the kind of place where we may get Gone with the Wind as a first run movie. And pretty much there's a theater complex 40 minutes away. And pretty much on every screen is Teenage Ninja Mutant Turtles. That's the kind of place that it is. You can't get the New York Times delivered the same day.
Does anyone there know who you are?
No, very few. You know, I mean, they may know. It's never mentioned. Most people don't know. It's never brought up. And, you know, I mean, friends know, but the public at large doesn't know, which is good. And it's quiet. And I really felt I needed that quiet. Now, people say, well, you know, anger was your edge and agitation was your edge, and that's going to hurt your writing. I don't know. It may be that in order to live a happier life, you become a shittier writer. I don't know. And I actually think about that. I mean, I always was angry. I always had an agitation. And have I lost that edge as a writer, whatever edge someone has to kind of keep you going? But I couldn't live in that fashion. I just couldn't. And, you know, I think it would have destroyed my marriage, and it was just destroying me. And, you know, I realized that I'm actually a pretty thoughtful person. I mean, you know, I write with passion. I always wanted to write with passion. But, you know, to do some of the stuff that I've done requires a lot of thought. And I do think a lot. I mean, I think a lot. It may not sound that way when it comes out, but I mean, I really dwell over, you know, what I write. I mean, the ending to the Nick Foles piece where, you know, calling him chicken shit was, as I said, was probably. But I thought about that. Is it gratuitous? Is it a cheap shot? Well, it's not. He has no edge. And will that matter? Will it not matter? I don't know. But I think that's the flaw, that he just, whatever it is, he's missing it. And, you know, that was something that I felt was borne out by the story. So, I mean, there is a method to the madness. But when you're tweeting an hour, you know, you don't even know what the fuck you're saying after a while. You're just sort of blabbing out and douche juice and fuck this and fuck that and fuck this and fuck that. And, you know, just wasn't, you know, it was just too provocative. It was too mean. You're losing friends. And I just don't want to do that.
How are you doing now?
So maybe they'll retire my number, my Twitter
number. No one else can claim Buzz Bissinger?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's, you know, the thing with Twitter is it's very hard to get off of it. So I think I'm off of it. They make it very, very hard. That's the part they don't tell you. But I'm off, you know, I never did Facebook that much, but I don't do any of that stuff anymore. It wasn't helping. you know, I'm good. I mean, I'm much more centered. My wife and I love being in Washington State. And we spend a lot of time together, which we love. We work in the same place. And life is good. You know, I have moments of career anxiousness just because it's harder now. I mean, it's not easy out there. The money is less. The opportunities are, you know, more difficult. I have a lot of work, but they're not paying as much. And, you know, you worry about security. I mean, I don't have any security. You know, I've had health benefits for a long time because of teleplays and screenplays. But that every business is changing. Every creative business is changing. You know, I'm everyone's going through it.
You have legitimate financial concerns, like for Friday Night Life didn't.
Yeah, I do because of Zach. Zach, that's what life is. I mean, Zach, to ensure his future when I'm gone and his mom is gone, I mean, that costs a certain amount of money. You always have legitimate concerns when you see your income, you know, appreciably lower than it was. You worry about, look, writing's not as fresh as it used to be. It just isn't. I remember David Halberstam saying, the first one you do for love, the rest you do for money. And he did that really well, and he had a real method to it. You know, and he pretty much came out with a book once every 2 years, sports book, general book. I'm not very prolific. I tend to procrastinate a lot. But, does it have that dazzle, that excitement? No, I mean, I write pieces that I like. I wrote a piece about Duncan, Oklahoma, where that Australian baseball player was killed that I liked a lot. You know, I did another piece for Vanity Fair that should run soon on the theft of this $5 million violin in Milwaukee. It's like a Coen Brothers movie, frankly, and it's serendipitous absurdity. But you do sit there and you say, man, it's hard to come up with an original sentence. And frankly, you do write something, you say, that sounds familiar because you wrote it before. And thinking in your head to come up with a preposition or to describe something gets harder. I mean, it just does. And I know writers like, obviously I'm not Philip Roth or close to him, but you know, he's quit for that reason. It just gets harder. I try to write with vividness, and I try to write in a cinematic fashion. And writing is a solitary act. I miss collaboration. I never really had collaboration in my life. I'm working on a screenplay now for Sony TriStar based on a terrific autobiography by R.A. Dickey, the major league pitcher who won the Cy Young throwing a knuckleball at the age of 38. But I still, you know, love a good story, and, you know, I just hope that, you know, a book idea really hits and really resonates that uses all my cylinders. But it's daunting to think, am I going to move to an Odessa, Texas when I'm 60 years right. old? Am I going to spend 5.5 years, you know, writing A Prayer for the City? No, that's a big chunk of time. You know, people have spent 15 years on great books that no one ever reads. And I know that, you know, publishing may be in the shitter, but you know what? There are a lot of books that are published. I went to a bookstore yesterday. Jesus Christ, so many fucking books. And, you know, it's like, it's daunting. You know, how are you going to get any space anywhere? You know, shelves and shelves and shelves and shelves of books of all, and a lot of them are ridiculous. I mean, those strange subjects that no one would read. And, you know, where am I going to get, where's there going to be a space, a space for me? So I guess I should write Saturday Night Lights and Sunday Night Lights and whatever the hell it should be.
Season with a high school lacrosse team.
Oh, that's been done. Don't worry.
Maybe there's a book in rehab.
I thought about that a little bit. I'm just not prepared or ready to do it. I don't think it's a good time to do it. I think, you know, there was a lot of damage that was done. It's about repairing relationships. It's proving to my wife that, you know, we can live. I did a lot of bad things. I mean, I did beyond what I wrote about. I mean, you know, there was infidelity. There was playing around with drugs. There was suicide ideation. I mean, there was a lot going on. She was very humiliated. We did split up. She went through a lot, and she really stood by me, which has been great because she's magnificent. You know, she's great. I'm very now dependent on her.
Was rehab your call or
yes,
hers?
Rehab was my call. I had gone to a very good therapist here in Philadelphia, a woman named Penny Stark, and I felt that as good as she was, once a week wasn't enough, and just too much was unraveling, and she felt the same way, and I really had to get concentrated. It's not fun. I mean, rehab is not fun a lot, and I think it's much harder. My addictions were, in a sense, sexual. My addictions were stemming from shame and humiliation and embarrassment that I'd felt all my life. There was a lot going on. If it's alcohol or drugs, as good as rehab is, I think those are really, really hard habits to kick. And there's a lot of feeling now that there should be another way to do it. The thing about rehab is it's great when you're there, in a sense. And as they pointed out, you know what's great about rehab for you guys? You're all narcissists, so you get a ton of attention. You know, you're getting attention all the time. You're getting all this therapy, and you can say whatever you want. You know, much harder when you're outside. You're not going to get as much attention, so they're very honest about it. But I got a lot out of it. I felt for me the therapy was both good and valuable. And you know, I still think about the things that resonate, you know, in trying to get, you know, what happens? You get into a hole and trying to get out of the hole and appreciate, you know, the wonders of life.
You feel like you're getting there?
Yeah, I do really well in the Northwest because it's quiet. When I come back to Philly, I feel a greater sense of agitation. I've always had this feeling that people sort of, you know, and it's not, you know, what have you done for me lately? What are you working on? You know, I hate that question. What are you working on? And they ask it in good faith because they're curious, and I've written things, I do the interesting things, but then I get all intense. Well, I'm not really agitated. Well, I'm not really working on anything. Why are you asking? Do you think I'm a loser? You know, do you just know me for Friday Night Lights? I mean, the fucking 25th anniversary has come out. I wrote that book when I was 34. Can we move on? I mean, it's all this bullshit that comes to the fore, but it you know, clogs in your head. I mean, I'm learning how to ride a motorcycle, which I've always wanted to do. Now, you talk about idealized suicide ideation, but Lisa, my wife, rides one. And I've gotten out there, and it's fun, and it's different. My relationship with nature has become somewhat profound because where we live is absolutely magnificent, and I am happier. I mean, I am definitely happier and more centered. I was never really centered. Most writers are not centered. Most writers are the opposite of centered. You know, you get. I don't think there can be anything more boring than getting a group of journalists together. For people who spend their lives writing about others, maybe that's when they get together, all they do is talk about themselves. Of course, most people in life only talk about themselves, and I actually do like to listen. But I've sort of come to the conclusion in life that sometimes it's just better to be with your dog and your wife, because all you do is, you know, conversation has become an excuse to talk about yourself and not engage. I've made you silent.
That's a tough line to follow.
Well, I do think about that. And I think it's just, you know, I think we're all narcissistic at heart. And I think listening is hard. Listening is a lost art.
You good at it?
Yeah, I actually am good at it. And I actually enjoy it. I mean, I really, you know, I ask questions because I'm a journalist. And I learn things. I mean, I learn things, you know, a little thing here, a little thing there. And I enjoy the process that other people use. And I do enjoy it. And I also think it makes for better, you know, better conversation. I don't like talking. I don't like ever talking about what I'm working on. I just don't.
Have you gotten better at listening or worse at listening?
My wife, Lisa, said that I was a great listener when she first met me, and then I'd become a terrible listener. And I think I have become a better listener, not because it's like a nice thing to do. It's fun to listen. You know, that's how you learn about things. I will say the other thing about people is the amount of misinformation that people give out is appalling. However, I realize that, you know, you hear something and you don't remember it verbatim. But, you know, still, because I like to actually have facts when I speak, and, you know, because I'm getting Alzheimer's, I don't remember a lot of things. But it's amazing what people talk about without any basis in fact whatsoever.
Is there something, like, in particular you're thinking of?
No, I mean, you know, it's like, I forget, it came up in the context of someone was talking about something in sports, and he was having a conversation, and the person said, well, you know, every Division I football team makes money. And he was completely adamant about that. Well, that's absolutely not true. I think at most 40% make money. And I think there are 5 Division I programs that actually make money for their athletic department. But, you know, I sort of go back to a poll that was done that a third of Americans think there actually were weapons of mass destruction. So, I mean, you know, we do live in an age of misinformation. I mean, look at what's reported and how it's reported. You know, Do we really know what happened in the St. Louis shooting? Something appalling happened. Leaving that kid out for 4 hours is appalling. But do we know the circumstances of how he was shot? We can surmise. But it used to be you really tried. You really tried to learn, to know. I mean, you know, in the Zimmerman case, CNN has learned that Zimmerman used the word nigger. Well, then they say that, and then they say, well, maybe we should have an audio expert listen. And then the audio expert says there's no way you can tell what he said. Well, why didn't you do that before? And CNN has learned. CNN, I mean, their coverage of that Malaysian plane that disappeared was farcically funny. CNN has learned that the plane may be somewhere in the hemisphere. CNN has learned that it may be in the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, or the Pacific. Well, fuck what CNN has learned, because they haven't learned anything. See, but now you got me all agitated.
Yeah, like shouldn't you be like tuning that out?
Well, you know, honestly, you have to find a balance. You know, you get out of rehab and you want to see Kumbaya, you want to sing Kumbaya all the time.
How long were you there for?
2 months, 60 days. You want to see, and then my wife and I did an intensive couples counseling. You do 4 days straight, just one-on-one with one therapist, which I really do recommend. That was incredibly helpful for both of us. But you get out and there's the rehab glow. You're going to do meditation for an hour and then you're going to do yoga for 2 hours and you're going to, you know, sit in a circle and look at the sun coming down, and that lasts for, you know, a couple months. But, I don't want to lose who I am, but I don't want to get just completely worked up all the time. I mean,
how do you find that balance?
It's a good question. And finding it, frankly, is sometimes elusive. I will say this: living, writing always produced a lot of anxiety for me. I try not just to do it, to sort of shed that fear. And I've had a very productive ride. I mean, you know, Vanity Fair piece, two Vanity Fair pieces, a piece for Philly Mag, you know, pitching the screenplay successfully, just by going into it and saying, you know what, have fun. As long as you're doing the best, you know, and I did the story about Duncan, Oklahoma, on the tragic killing of this baseball player, you know, I didn't know what I was going to get. That's a difficult situation to parachute into. And opposed, you know, I just said, oh, just do what you can. If you do the best you can and it doesn't work, it doesn't work. As opposed to saying, I must have done something wrong. I must have fucked this up. Why didn't that person talk to me? I should have approached it differently, or I fucked it up. I really try not to do that.
What was the fear?
That I wouldn't get anything, that I there just was no angle of approach, that how do I get in? Obviously, the town doesn't really want to talk about, you know, I'm not going to get to the kids. How am I going to come up with anything that's fresh or new? But, you know, doors open. I have to be honest. A lot of doors open because of Friday Lights. So you get over that fear and just, you know, you just a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, a little bit there. And then you use your sort of repertorial instincts and something. Then it's fun. You know, when you see the crack and the crack becomes a fissure and the fissure becomes a canyon, then it's really fun. You know, wow. All right.
Did that moment not used to be fun?
Getting to that moment, it was always fun, but getting to that moment was sort of terrifying. You know, a lot of curled up in the fetal position. Before I went to rehab, I would nap 2 to 3 hours a day just to get away from life. And I don't nap anymore. You know, I don't. I didn't really care about sleeping as much as just wanting to. I was so scared, so much fear, so much anxiety about everything. This is so much sort of denigration of myself that it was the only relief, I could get. You know, Lisa really keeps me going. And we have a great time together. A lot of laughs and wonderful intimacy and a great, great yellow lab named Maddie. Who, you know, dogs are spiritual. I don't know if you have one, but they're they're amazing.
She's made many appearances on this podcast.
Really?
Dog? Yeah, cool. She sits in the studio every time.
How cool is that? What kind of dog?
She's like a lab pit mix.
Oh, they're so great. She's getting old and I worry about her. But, you know, where we are, and it didn't cost a lot. We sold our house in Philadelphia, which I want to get rid of. I didn't like the economic pressure of it. We bought this house. We have no mortgage. It has a pristine view of the Willapa Bay, which is a great repository for some of the best oysters in the country. There's no one around us. It's the cleanest natural estuary in the United States. You see the Willapa Hills across the bay. Every sunset and sunrise is magical. You know, the glint of the water, the tide. You know, coming here is great because I see the kids and I see friends. But I do feel tranquility there and peace of mind there, and not anxiousness and not career fear. And, you know, why am I not doing a book? Why can't I come up with an idea? What the fuck is wrong with me? And, you know, why is Vanity Fair holding the story? And where's the next assignment going to come from? And the screenplay's all fucked up. And it is actually fucked up because I'm procrastinating like crazy. But it lessens out there. I do enjoy.
Sounds healthy.
It is healthy. I mean,
I'm happy for you.
Yeah. No, it really is. Healthy. Do I like action? Yeah. I mean, do I like bright lights? Yeah. Do I like expensive, beautiful clothing? Yeah. You know, I was lucky enough to do a really ridiculously fun story for Departures magazine, the American Express, on, you know, risque nightlife in Miami. So, you know, that was fun.
When was that?
That was a couple of weeks ago. It hasn't run yet. It was just fun. You know, you got all these clubs and, you know, they want attention and publicity. So they give you VIP treatment, and it was fun, you know, so I get enough bright lights, but it is healthy. That's why I would never, ever live in New York as a writer. Would never.
You never really did, right?
No. I toyed about moving to New York because I was from there. It's a great city, but I would get eaten up. I just would get eaten up by who's doing this, who's doing that. And it just would kill me. I mean, I just would not be able to take that. I remember when I worked in Hollywood for a year for NYPD Blue, and, you know, we would get free copies of Variety. Well, the only reason Variety existed was to depress screenwriters, basically. Deal cut for $1.8 million. Deal cut here, you know. Green light given, and you would read it, and I would read it. I would read it after lunch, and I would go lie on the couch for about 2.5 hours, and that's not apocryphal. And then I you know, it was that stage of my life where I had to read it, wanted to know what's going on. I don't really know anything. You know, I used to be well-versed in journalism. I'm sort of the last to know.
Reading back through your stuff, there's kind of two strains of writing, and a third if you'd want to take in the Twitter stuff into account. But there's kind of like, there's this very personal, very confessional kind of writing that you do. And then there's this journalism that's not, I wouldn't say it's straight ahead, but you're not in the story. You're often not in the story. I wonder what the bridge between those two things is.
I don't know if there is a bridge, although they are very, very distinct. One's actually kind of very traditional, almost old-fashioned. You know, obviously I have a voice when I write, but I purposely try to stay out of it. And I guess maybe I felt at some point that we were either I was tired of straight narrative or wanted to write something that was more personally revealing. And it may have been that I don't feel people feel really do write honestly about themselves. I think they do want to be the hero of their own story. Were people turned off in Father's Day because I was so honest? Yeah, some people were. And some people were appalled, you know, and that's fine. I mean, people do have a right to their opinion. I think in narrative long form, I'm moving back towards the more old-fashioned, traditional, straight-on narrative where I'm not in it because I do believe that that's what's needed now. Reporting, maybe even a less voice, although I still write with a lot of voice, but more traditional, good, solid reporting, even if I did call Nick Foles chicken shit.
I mean, you are writing about things that you're passionate about.
I try. Yeah, that's true. I mean, Duncan, I'll Go Home, and not to keep harping on it, that was something I suggested at Vanity Fair. I like small towns. I'm interested in how small towns tick. It was an incredibly tragic story. And the idea that some kid would be a 20-year-old kid with his life ahead of him is walking down the street and gets blown away by three kids in a passing car was disturbing and somewhat incomprehensible. And to me, it said something is ticking in that town. I wrote about Nick Foles for Philly Mag because I was interested in him. You know, we had a common denominator. Look, if some things you do for the money, some things you just do. But, you know, it's hard enough to write about something if you don't really give a shit about it. But if you're passionate, then maybe you have a shot. I've always felt that.
What appeals to you about frauds, about stories about frauds? There's a bunch of those.
Yeah, there is a bunch of those.
And Glass, the Doctor.
Why did I get into journalism? I got into journalism because I love newspapers. Newspapers were thriving at the time. My first professional job was in 1976. It was the height of Watergate. You know, I learned about long form then. You know, my first job was running 100-inch stories. They may not have been very good, but I mean, 100-inch story, your first job as a rookie reporter, that's unheard of. But I got in because of the public's right to know. You know, that to me was really, really important. And I forget the name. Was it the Ed Asner show where he played the editor? I mean, you know, Rossi. People used to call me Rossi, and that was an image that I liked. You know, to be hard-hitting, to be incisive, to report things out. And I do have a very heightened sense of right and wrong. So Stephen Glass infuriated me. This doctor who, you know, faked all these nasal sinus surgeries infuriated me because what they did was so absolutely egregious. And I think when someone does something egregious like that, they should be exposed.
You wrote a epilogue to Friday Night Lights,
right,
in 2012.
You mean the ebook?
Yeah, after Friday Night Lights.
Right. It was really about Booby, right.
But it felt to me like reading it, it was like you were trying to make something right. Like it, I think you
still turned out terribly wrong. As it turned out,
how so?
Well, After Friday Night Lights was an ebook that was written then for Byliner, and it was about my relationship with Booby Miles. It's a very complex relationship, and I did feel somewhat responsible. I actually feel, and I know reporters and writers will probably be horrified at this. I feel that the subjects of stories should get paid, actually. But I felt in the case of Booby, to see what he went through, to see his life pass in front of his eyes, to get hurt before your senior year when you thought you were going to be a showcase for the nation and play college football and pro football, to be called a dumb old nigger, to have no education, that really got to me. And so I felt some obligation to help him out financially. After Friday Night Lights was about my relationship, my complex relationship, his difficulty in really sort of living and in having any stability, and to what degree was he defined by that single moment of ruining his knee in a meaningless preseason game. The problem was, and we split the profits. You know, he never read what I wrote. Split the profits. I felt that was fair. And it was a way of almost putting money in his hands without just simply giving it to him.
How'd the book do?
The book did well. I mean, for an ebook, it sold about 110,000 copies. The problem was about 6 months later, he violated his probation and went to prison. And I have not talked to him since then because I just felt he was beyond help or beyond my help. And I don't know if the money was doing any good. I don't know where it went. He's an adult. I'm not going to tell him where it should go, but his lawyer called me and wanted me to fly down and be a character witness. And I just felt at that point, I can't, you know, Booby, I've tried for years and I just can't help anymore. And it was tragic.
Think about him?
Yeah, I think about him, but I also think, you know, you had someone here, you know, and people say, well, you're just being self-aggrandizing as to how great and how charitable you are. And that's not the case. I mean, I really did love him and care about him, but you know, he had a good chunk of money that could have bought a house where he was living in Kermit, that could have helped his kids. I mean, you know, all he had to do was go to the probation officer and stay off drugs, and he didn't. And I began to wonder if I was just aiding and abetting his bad habits and making him think that whenever anything got in a pinch, he could call and depend on me. And that can't happen anymore. It was a significant amount of money, and I care about him, but I don't know if he can ever get it together. And he's very personable. He's funny. He's got a good sense of humor, but I don't think he really likes the work. I mean, I wonder if some way, if he is stuck in time and still thinks of himself as a star. And what was weird and what I felt really badly about was he was kind of a star when the movie came out, you know, and people would recognize him, but he didn't get anything out of that. Right. He didn't get a thing out of that. The movie didn't, they gave him virtually nothing. I mean, I supplemented it, which doesn't make me good, but that was weird to be a star with nothing. You know, what did he get out of it? Really nothing.
And a star for the worst moment of your life.
Exactly. So you never get away from it. Maybe if we lived in the same town or something, you know, where I was there every day, but you know, he's not one of my children, and he's not young anymore. He's probably in his, he's in his early 40s. So, you know, so I broke it off. I don't know what, I mean, obviously I hope he's safe and sound. I don't know if he's still in prison or not.
It's great to hear that, that you are doing so well, that, you are making progress in your life. I'm interested in your style. Has it evolved at all in the last year and change?
Style in terms of
fashion style. What are you wearing is what I'm asking.
I like strutting out. I mean, I do.
You're and, still strutting.
I still strut. I still wear a lot of leather, which I love to wear. I mean, I still love beautiful clothing. I'm not buying nearly as much. I've cut down a lot. I miss it. But, you know, I love interesting, beautiful, exotic things. I mean, I just like, maybe I like the attention, although it's more, this is me. Where did it come from? I don't fucking know. But it's there, and why deny it? You know, some people love the look. Some people think it's insane. I've toned down probably a little bit just because some of the styles were really outrageous. But, you know, I mean, this closet's filled with gorgeous leather jackets and gorgeous suit jackets and sport coats from Gucci. I bought nothing from Gucci this year. It really killed me. I mean, I really, really miss it. So I do, you know, strut out. And that's a part of me. That's a good part of me. And I don't want, you know, you just can't sort of change your life and say, well, I'm going to walk out of everything. Now, I will say in Oregon and Washington State, there's much, you know, Gucci is really, A, it's not a big deal there. B, it's really kind of frowned upon. And, you know, so if you walk out in Gucci, they're going to think you're really insane. But, one of the fun things about coming out here is I can strut it out. And, you know, I still do.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Because it did feel in that story like there was a lot going on, but that part of it felt true.
Oh, that part was totally true. I mean, I and people, what's that about? I don't know, but I love it. I mean, I like high fashion. Now I'm in the process of trying. I mean, I have a storage locker in Philadelphia that probably has, I don't know, 150 pieces in it that I am trying to sell because it's just sitting there. But then I look at them and say, oh, they're like my little children. I can't get rid of them. Although some of them are really fucking outrageous, but I think they're really cool. You know, and I'm open about that. Women's clothes, men's clothing, who cares as long as you like it? You know, it doesn't bother me.
I feel like you know yourself. You're as close as you've ever been.
I think I'm close as I've ever been to being feeling centered, to feeling a peace and an honest tranquility. I don't want to say that I don't get agitated. I get more agitated here. I get more anxious here. I think the further east I go, there's more the sense of what have I done lately. But more centered, more listening genuinely, more trying to do things that, you know, I wouldn't do, like learning how to ride a motorcycle, like, you know, hiking. I even do, I mow the lawn. I mean, you know, I sort of garden a little bit. My wife gets me out there. And just feeling, you know, enjoying life to the degree that I can enjoy it. Any project is going to, you know, be anxiety producing, but learning how to try to, in terms of the advice I gave, just trying to work through it. Just work through it and not making it painful. You know, you cannot make things painful. You cannot have to agonize over everything. Maybe you'll even make it fun. And if you make it fun and that fun is expressed on the page, it may be pretty good.
I want to go back to confidence as a writer.
Sure.
For a second. It is genuinely wonderful to hear that you have found a place where you are feeling more confident. Not every writer has the kind of work under his or her belt that you do, or B, the means to buy a nice house in a beautiful place that can calm them down and get out of this race.
Right. I do want to point out that this house costs a lot less than what we were, the house in Philadelphia. I mean, part of it was downsizing. This is not a big, elaborate house.
That's fair. My question is what your advice might be to yourself as a younger writer, or to younger writers in general, about how to find that confidence or at least overcome that fear, how to think about your writing when it can feel so overwhelming.
Look, I mean, you know, and I don't think this is specific to writers, but I think it is a little bit more specific because the creative act is so fraught with peril. You know, you can do something wonderful and no one pays attention to it. You can do something terrible and a lot of people pay attention to it. There's an agony to it. There's a remoteness to it. There's an isolation to it. There's a loneliness to it. And confidence is the key. I mean, it's the key to everything, I think, in terms of profession, really, probably in terms of living. And when I just tell myself, you know what, just do it. And don't do it like every cent. Just get it out on paper. Don't attach all this, is it going to be good? Is it going to win a National Magazine Award? All the things that people, is it going to sell? Is it going to be made into a movie? Just relax. Be disciplined enough to write for a certain number of hours per day, whatever you're comfortable with. Some people can do 10, I can't. Some people do 6, some people do 5. After 4, I'm pretty much tapped out, and then you go back over what you've written. There's no worse feeling, and I've done this, and I still do it time to time, than you look at the computer screen, and it's empty 4 hours later. That's a terrible feeling, and that only makes fear worse. And the only way to conquer the fear, at least, is just do it. And I guarantee you, even if it sucks, and a lot of times it does suck, you will feel so much better because now you have something to work with. Now you have something physical to play with, to change. But there is that relief that you have been through the agony. Now you have that first draft, and it may suck, but all right. And forget the negative. You're going to see, you know what? It's not so bad. You know what? I see a pathway here. This, you know, shift here, a scene here, a section here of the book. I see an interesting pathway. You know what? Maybe I see a better way to tell the narrative. And I guarantee you that you will feel, I think, much better. And, you know, hopefully you'll hit that curve of delicious, euphoric, orgasmic confidence. You're not going to hit it on every story. And, you know, people say, how's it going? And say it honestly, fine, it's going fine. And once you have something palpable and physical, it's going to make you feel better. And then it really gets, I think, fun. Because now when you're writing, you're doing what you have. You're piecing together, you're pulling stuff out, you're putting stuff in. And that is always much less anxiety provoking than getting out that fresh first start.
Is that pretty much your plan now? Just do it?
Yeah, I mean, when I did the magazine pieces, I just did them. I mean, I did them. And screenwriting which I've done in the past, is different because it's sort of like, it's not starting over, but it's such a different form and I kind of get out of shape. But yes, that's what I do now.
What would you say to a writer who's maybe worrying quite a bit about what people think of their work?
Look, I mean, you're always going to, you do worry about what, people think. Critics are critics. You know, some have loved what I've done. Some have hated what I've done. I almost think that's good because I think if there's universal opinion about that, it's all great. I actually think there's a way to do that by not taking chances when you write. My editor called it kind of auto-writing. You know, good writers can write in kind of an autopilot way. It's not very inspirational. It's not very original, and critics like that. Plus, it's very important what the Wall Street Journal writes because they're always first, and everyone imitates the Wall Street Journal. So either hope you get a great review in the Wall Street Journal or hope that the Wall Street Journal doesn't review your book. But you shouldn't worry about what people think. Here's what I think you should worry about is getting people to read it. What does that mean? Storytelling. What does that mean? Thinking about narrative. What does that mean? Vivid writing. What does that mean? Taking you into a subculture that no one knew existed, whether it's baseball, whether it's Barbaro, whatever the hell it is. Worry about that. Worrying about in newspapers, I felt we were in a, and it's probably maybe I think it's less of a problem. I think they almost discovered it. It was such an insulated world. Hey, that was a great story. Hey, that was a great story, and no one really said, well, maybe a great story inside the newsroom. Didn't even fucking read it. Did anyone really care? So if you concentrate on the tools, and it's not said because I'm doing this with you, of narrative, getting people to read it, trying to develop character. Cutting. I'm much better at cutting stuff out. That's what you should worry about. Why is there a book business? Because no one knows what the public's going to like. You know, if everyone knew what the public liked, there'd be 4 books written a year. Same with movies. And, you know, you miss a lot. You hit a lot, you know, and criticism of others is criticism of others. They have every right to say what they want. It's going to be, you know, arbitrary. I was at the racetrack yesterday at Saratoga, and I was thinking about it. You know, for all these can't miss shots, how many people who go there for like hours and hours and study the racing form, they all get it wrong. And, you know, look at the variance of things that people like. There are always 30% of critics who hate it. You know, so what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Don't write for others, but I don't believe you should only just write for yourself unless you're just completely, you know, brilliant and on a different plateau. Worry about getting people to read it, because if you write something that people don't want to read, that to me is debilitating. And really, you want people to read what you write.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading the next thing that you write.
Well, that's good. I hope so. I think it's coming out, I think, in a month. You know, it was a very gentle note to Graydon Carter saying, when's the story going to run? And Graydon, who I adore, said, stop getting your tit in a ringer. It'll run, which I thought was great. And I've had a great run with them. And I will say that we all talk doomsday. It's still a great place to work. So I feel very fortunate in having that. And look, if anyone out there has any good book ideas, my email, can I give out my email?
Sure. They can't contact you on Twitter.
No, I'm not on Twitter or Facebook. You can contact me by email, buzz.bissinger, B-I-S-S-I-N-G-E-R, @gmail.com, because I often find funky great ideas come from other people. You know, just good stories.
A piece of advice to anyone who might email Buzz. If he says no or just doesn't write you back, just keep writing him an email like every 6 weeks.
Yeah, be like Max. Just if you write an email every 6 weeks, but I sometimes they fall through the cracks. I do try to write everyone back because, you know, they've taken the effort to write you. If it's a really good idea and I do it, there will be no cut, but there will be a lot of gratitude. Silent.
Thank you for finally doing this, man. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, I appreciate your coming to Philly. You're much more handsome and younger than I thought, by the way. I thought you'd be like 60s, sort of like a professor who's had much better days. Plus, Max Linsky just sounds like a Woody Allen character, basically.
I had this moment. I met a guy at like a party who listened to the podcast. And we were talking for a while, and he was like, what do you do? And I was saying, whatever, whatever. And I was like, oh, yeah, I do this podcast. And he was like, oh, wait a second. Are you Max? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, oh, I thought you were going to be like a fat dude in a fedora.
I didn't think of fat dude in a fedora. I thought you'd be like 60s and sort of, you know, a little hippie-ish and kind of scraggly gray hair and somewhat groomed, but I don't know if you had showered in the past day or two. And, you know, dedicated to this strange thing called long-form journalism, which probably has as much interest to people as the Phillies today.
Clearly, I'm not quite no. putting out the honest impression of myself.
No, you're not. I think you need to hire a PR person. I think you have to work on your public persona. Although your voice is pretty on the young side. But no, you have to do something. Because no one would possibly know that you're... Well, they would know what you're 35 or they're listening to. I don't know. How many people listen to this? Like 4?
Yeah, like 50,000 a week.
Really?
I didn't want to tell you that until then.
Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, then do you ever put pictures out of yourself?
Not really, no.
I mean, Max Linsky sounds like a guy out of the 30s. You know, a Damon Union character who eats at the Carnegie Deli like twice a week and gets a big pastrami sandwich.
I've been thinking about that a lot, man, because I'm...
I'm serious.
I'm going to have a kid.
When?
That's great. She's due Thursday.
No! Really? Congratulations.
Yeah, I was petrified.
Oh, that's great.
That she was going to go into labor.
If you canceled this,
if I had canceled it,
there's no way it was going to happen. No way. Well, congratulations.
I've been thinking a lot about Linsky. What you name someone named Linsky?
Do you live in New York?
Yeah.
Where?
Brooklyn.
Infamous Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Is it too gentrified now? What do you think?
I mean, I am a gentrifier.
I don't know Brooklyn at all. It's amazing.
I live in Fort Greene. Gentrified neighborhood.
It's amazing. When I grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in New York, you know, you would never, ever have any rational reason to go to Brooklyn. Ever. And now it's just exploding. Every great restaurant's in Brooklyn. And now there are all these backlash stories that it's getting ruined and you got to move to Queens. There was a story in the Times. I read some Times.
It was about people who can't afford the rent anymore.
Well, you have a lot of money? Do you make a lot doing this?
No.
Because if you did... I'd start buying in Queens.
I think Staten Island is the move.
Ah, no. Ah.
There's beautiful houses out there, man.
It's the worst.
No, no, there's beautiful houses.
I know, in New Dorp and all those fucking shitty-ass places. Forget Staten Island. No, that's not going to happen. Max, I'm telling you, you got a kid. You have to be more responsible. You can make some money. Queens. I'm telling you, Queens. If you have 50,000 people, you're probably like, what, $3 or $4 million a year, right?
Yeah, it doesn't really work like that with this, though.
Well, it actually was a lot of fun, so thank you for coming.
Thank you, Buzz. Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Jenna, I'll never doubt you again. Our intern this week, Rachel Mabe. Thanks to my guest, Buzz Bissinger, for finally relenting. That was the best Monday morning I've had in quite some time. Thanks also to our sponsors. You guys, this writer's residency that Tiny Letter is funding is amazing. If you're a writer, you really should apply. 10 days, all expenses paid at the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs. residency.tinyletter.com. Go check it out. I'm one of the judges, and I told them I would only do it if I could give preferential treatment to long-form podcast listeners. So now you have no excuse. Apply. And finally, go download the brand new Longform app. It's 100% free. It's for iPhone and iPad, and it nearly cost Aaron several vital organs. Seriously, we worked very hard on this app. Our goal was to build a home for the kind of writing we're talking about on the show every week, and I think we did exactly that. It's good. I genuinely believe that it is good and that you will like it. Please check it out. And if you do like it, tell your friends. Okay, we'll be back and strutting out next week.